Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we're well into January, the time of year when many of us focus on ways to be a better person, thinner, wealthier, more organized, and most of our ambitions have crashed against some serious obstacles already, leaving us feeling defeated. Maybe it's time to end our latest self-improvement projects and reclaim the power of who we already are. Janine Roth is the author of 10 books, including the New York Times bestsellers When Food is Love and Women, Food, and God. Her latest book is called This Messy, Magnificent Life, and it's now in paperback. You may have seen Janine Roth on Super Soul Sunday or Good Morning America or The Oprah Winfrey Show, but now she joins us on the phone from San Francisco for In the Moment. Janine Roth, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
This book begins with what I call this permission to exhale, this sense that maybe it's okay to end the great me project, whatever that might be for you. Tell us about just the beginning of this book, where it began for you as you started writing it and where it really begins for readers.
Well, I had been in decades of therapy and also I can't even count the diets that I'd been on and the many times I had attempted to change, fix, alter myself, get rid of parts of myself, and somehow they had never really, really worked. And so I realized that. I mean, I realized that about dieting years ago, which is why I gave it up and wrote a couple of my books about the relationship with food, and then I started realizing it on a more widespread level, that it didn't really work to try to get rid of parts of myself, that there was another way of being with myself, of being with ourselves, that was more effective.
Do you hear from readers, and this book is now in paperback, when it came out in hardcover, did you get that sort of immediate response that people were saying, finally, someone gave me permission to just kind of, embrace the fact that life is messy and we all have these challenges that we're dealing with, just maybe different challenges than the person next to us on the bus?
Yeah, I did get that. I'm still getting that. Because I think we all feel that. There's a sense of ongoing helplessness, what to do with all these different, not just parts of ourselves, but also what to do in the face of so much that we are looking at in the world, and this sense of where's our part, how do we handle it, what do we do, and I think increasingly it gives people a sense of despair and helplessness. And I certainly found that in the relationship with food, with people and our endless diets. And what do we eat? Do we follow the paleo diet, the keto diet, the Mediterranean diet? Do we go on Weight Watchers? Do we do intermittent fasting? What exactly do we do? Where do we start? How do we begin?
You have had struggles in your life. You've had tragedies in your life, financial devastation, escape from wildfires, and all kinds of things. And you've said in the past that these experiences have helped sort of awaken you to having life in a different way. How have you learned how to use the rotten things that we would love to avoid to get to a higher ground.
What I realized about myself, and I hope this isn't true for most people, is that it has taken catastrophes like with my weight. I lost and gained over 1,000 pounds. And I got to the point where I didn't want to live anymore because I was losing and gaining 10 pounds every other week. And I'm mostly overweight, but there was a while where I starved myself and became anorexic at 80 pounds. And then I couldn't stand it anymore. And so I went on a binge to end all binges, and I gained 80 pounds. I doubled my weight, within 2 months, and I was suicidal at that point. And that was the moment where I realized I cannot and I won't keep living like this. And so one of the options in those days was just ending my own life. But it was, I think, the crucible, the point of suffering that got me to see that there was another way, that I had never actually been curious about what food was doing for me, to me, how I was expressing myself through my relationship with food, that I'd never been interested in, because all I wanted to do was get rid of those pounds in any way I could. I didn't care how, with a belief that if I was thin, then everything that was wrong would be right. And that was the beginning of my journey with food, when I stopped dieting and I started being curious, and I became interested in, if food or my weight could talk, what would it say? What was I trying to say to get through to myself that I wasn't listening to? And then there was another time, which I write about in This Messy, Magnificent Life, where my husband and I lost every cent of our money in 2008, and it was terrifying, terrifying to find out that we had lost everything in a phone call. And it was that losing everything that got me to see that part of the fear. Now, of course, there was an objective reality that I needed to face, because I wasn't sure we could pay our rent that month. The other thing was how I had been living in scarcity for years and years and years, despite having a lot of money, the trance of scarcity, the trance of not having enough. And when we lost everything, in order not to go careening over the edge again, I realized that I needed to focus on what I did have, what I still had, what I had enough of, what, you know, that I had a teacup that I liked, that I had sardines in my cabinet, that my husband and I were together, that I had a roof over my head in that moment, that what the situation was bad, but what was worse were the stories I was telling myself. And that was the situation that helped me see that it was my mind that was a frightening place to be and over which I had control. I think that's the main thing. Yes, I didn't have control over the fact that we had lost everything, but I did have control over the stories I was telling myself and where I put my attention. So attention is a big thing, and I write about that in this book, because most of us don't realize that throughout the days we spend our attention, so to speak, and where you put your attention is where you put your energy, on what we don't have enough of, or what we believe is wrong, instead of the many things that we do have enough of and the things that are right. And the focus, that change of focus, allows us to actually come back to neutral ground and see what we actually can do.
There's a chapter in this book about an exercise you do with other women with a red string, and it gets this notion of, you know, what is enough? What kind of space am I allowed to take up? What do I feel like I'm allowed to have? And it brings up so much for the people who are participating in it. Walk us through that chapter, that exercise, a little bit with the red string and the lessons in it for all of us.
Yeah. I started doing that red string exercise with a therapist that I once had, and I thought it was a brilliant exercise. She handed me a piece of red string and told me to put it around myself in a circle, and told me I had an energetic space, and I rolled my eyes, and I thought, oh, my God, this is so California. What would my family in New York say this about energetic space? But it actually turns out that we all have one, because when somebody gets too close and sort of is in our face, so to speak, is standing too close, we know that we have that, because we already know, oh, they are standing too close to me. So there's a sense of space that we all have. And most people, and I work particularly, I mean, I work with women, and so I was going to say this is particularly true for women. And, of course, in these days with the Me Too movement and all that's going on about that and women, that has become much more highlighted. Everybody, I imagine, has this and has felt it violated, so to speak, in some way. In that red string exercise, you put it around yourself. It's a 6-foot piece of string, and I do this in my retreats, and the women are astonished at what they find. And you close the ends of the circle, so you put a circle around yourself that you're in the middle, and it's however much you feel the space you need. And some women don't feel they can take any space, and the string is wound so tightly around themselves that it's completely close to their bodies. And some people ask for another piece of string, and they make their circle so big that there's hardly any room for anybody else. What I found was that I felt like I wasn't allowed to close the ends of the red string, that I would get in trouble, that I wasn't allowed to say no. You know, as I say in the book, no is a complete sentence. I don't want to is a complete sentence. Most people don't feel that. And that's an indication that they feel like they're not allowed to have themselves. They're not allowed to own their own bodies. They're not allowed to own what they want. You know, they might not be able to have what they want, but even claiming that, even being aware of it, is hard for many people. And so what happens in my retreats when I give out these red strings and I give people a set of instructions is that, oh, I would say within 5 minutes, half the room is crying because they start realizing old beliefs that they have. And we all have a set of old beliefs that we are acting on and that we don't know that we're acting on. We just think they're true because we believe it, because we were told it. We think it's true, and we've never questioned it. And so they see the old beliefs about themselves and their bodies that they have, that they didn't even realize they have, but that they have been acting on for their entire lives.
And this is the notion of ghost children. Tell us a little bit about some of those beliefs and how they can kind of show up in our lives. And lots of people have, I think you say, like a whole daycare of little kids that they're tending to. And we should point out it's a serious book, but it's also just sharply funny at times as well.
Yes. Well, ghost children, you know, after I wrote that chapter, I found out that many people found that notion creepy, that when they heard the word ghost children, it was like, oh, no, ghost children, I'm inhabited by ghosts. And it's not like that. It's that all of us have parts of ourselves that I would say are frozen in the past, old or, if you will, younger parts that are undigested in a way. You know, the parts that felt like, for instance, never got enough, weren't cherished, didn't feel like we belonged, didn't feel like it was okay to be big energetically because the people around us were depressed or lonely or unhappy or sick. And so, again, we are inhabited by these voices, or we can call them beliefs, or we can call them identities, structures, whatever you want to call, that we don't actually realize that we have, that are operating through us. Most of us are schlepping our past along with us, like on top of our backs. Just imagine a big burden, or imagining a boat that we use to cross a river, and then we get to the other side and we take the boat and we put it on our backs while we climb a mountain and there's no water in sight. And that's how it is for most of us with our pasts. We are schlepping our past with us. We're expressing our past through the present. Most of us haven't even gotten into the present moment because we're so convinced that we're worthless or we're failures or we're doomed or there's no way that we have enough. We're not smart enough. We're not funny enough. Whatever it is, And this goes to whether you are in a partnership, whether you're successful at work, whether you live alone. It doesn't really matter what the outer expression of one's life is in terms of the beliefs that you carry along with you. Mm. Everybody has these beliefs, and it's good to question them, and that's what this book is about. And the first third of the book is about our relationship with food and, you know, the feeling of never getting what is enough, really, and also taking a look at how we use food, because how we do anything is how we do everything. Mm. And so food or anything else is a great way of looking at what are the beliefs that you have. It's a snapshot or a microcosm of your beliefs of enough and deprivation and nourishment. But then there's also the rest of your life. If you compare yourself to other people, I talk about the crazy ant in the attic. The one that's ranting on and on and on. For many people, it's an uncle. For many people, it's an image of a parent that tells you that no matter what you do, it's not good. It's not right. It's a shaming voice that everybody's got developmentally by the time we're four. Most of us believe it. And this voice is not our friend. So there's a chapter about that and how to work with that.